do we have this evening?
Whoa.
Creative as...
You sit there and speak.
I see.
It's unusual for us.
Yeah, that'll be...
That'll be a lot.
Yeah. Well, you can put a pineapple on your head.
That'll be different.
That would be different. Change from the same old grapefruit day
yesterday. Makes you bitter, that stuff. Does anyone have a specific topic we'd like to throw at our esteemed guest? Anyway, we're very happy to have you back here again.
Thank you very much.
Very kind of you to want to come.
It's my good fortune.
That's anything else.
Do we have a relationship with this book here? Is something we do?
It's been put before you by the grace of God.
Hmm.
I don't know who put that book there.
Sorry?
Who put that book there? Okay. Is there a particular verse you would like?
No. I was just thinking, if Maharaj wanted to use it, then there's, it's there, but if he doesn't, then he doesn't use it.
If you prefer another book, we have a whole...
We do have a whole library. I'm completely neutral in the matter. You want me to read from a different book? I'll read from a different book.
What book is that?
This is Bhagavad Gita as it is, second unauthorized edition. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Well, since it's here and since it's open. Kavim Puranam Manushashitaram Anurani Amsam Manusmare Jaha Sarvasya Tataram Achintya Rupam Aditya Varnam Tamasa Parastat. One should meditate upon the Supreme Person as the one who knows everything, as he who is the oldest, who is the controller, who is smaller than the smallest, who is the maintainer of everything, who is beyond all material conception, who is inconceivable, and who is always a person. He is luminous like the sun, and he is transcendental beyond this material nature. Who wanted to be? I'll be nice.
Sure.
I'll be super judge.
Purport. The process of thinking of the Supreme is mentioned in this verse. The foremost point is that he is not impersonal or void. One cannot meditate on something impersonal or void. That is very difficult. The process of thinking of Krishna, however, is very easy and is factually stated herein. First of all, the Lord is Purusha, a person. We think of the person Rama and the person Krishna. And whether one thinks of Rama or of Krishna, what he is like is described in this verse of the Bhagavad Gita. The Lord is Kavi, that is, he knows past, present, and future, and therefore knows everything. He is the oldest personality because he is the origin of everything. Everything is born out of him, and he is also the supreme controller of the universe, and he is the maintainer and instructor of humanity. He is smaller than the smallest. The living entity is 1/10,000th part of the tip of a hair, but the Lord is so inconceivably small that he enters into the heart of this particle, into the heart of this particle. Therefore he is called smaller than the smallest. As the Supreme, he can enter into the atom and into the heart of the smallest and control him as the supersoul. Although so small, he is still all-pervading and is maintaining everything. By him, all these planetary systems are sustained. We often wonder how these big planets are floating in the air. It is stated here that the Supreme Lord, by his inconceivable energy, is sustaining all these big planets and systems of galaxies. The word achintya, inconceivable, is very significant in this connection. God's energy is beyond our conception, beyond our thinking jurisdiction, and is therefore called inconceivable, achintya. Who can argue this point? He pervades this material world and yet is beyond it. We cannot comprehend even this material world, which is insignificant compared to the spiritual world. How so can we comprehend what is beyond? Achintya means that which is beyond this material world, and our argument, logical and philosophical speculation, cannot touch that which is inconceivable. Therefore, intelligent persons, avoiding useless argument and speculation, should accept what is stated in the scriptures like the Vedas, Bhagavad Gita, and Srimad Bhagavatam, and follow the principles they set down. This will lead one to understanding.
Om Agyana Tumiram Dasya Pranam Janashalaka Chakshurin Miditam Jina Tasmai Sri Gurave Nama Sri Chaitana Manabhistam Sthapitam Jina Bhutale Shriyam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Shapadantika Achintya Rupam. Interesting sort of juxtaposition. He has rupa, form, and achintya, you can't think about it. Achintya rupa. Of course, our acharyas have clarified that achintya means that beyond our speculative power. You could never think up Krishna. You could never dream up Krishna. Achintya rupa. Krishna can never be fully understood, and he can't be understood simply by the mind. Pantastukoti sadavat sadasam pragamya vayor tapi manaso muni pungavana. Even if we traveled at mental speed for thousands of years, we'd still not come within range of a tip of the toe of Govinda. So, by speculation, because the mind is matter, intelligence is matter, our matter will not reach the realm of spirit. But spirit can descend into matter. Atapi te deva padam bhujam harer. What is that? Atapi te deva prasadalesha anugrihita evi. Janasi tatvam bhagavan mahima. And a person who's got a little fragment of the mercy of the lotus feet of Krishna can understand Krishna. It's prasada lesh. Lesha means just a little remnant of Krishna's mercy. Janasi tatvam. He can understand Krishna factually. And Chiran Vichindam, simply thinking. These mental speculators won't get it. It requires Krishna's mercy. Kavim, one who knows everything. Puranam, the oldest person. And Anushashitanam, the controller of everything. Shastatu, control. And Anuraniyamsam, smaller than the smallest. Anur niya mahato mahiya. Smaller than the smallest and greater than the greatest. Great. Who are so great. Huge. Enormous. Gigantically enormous. The greater than the greatest. Whatever is great. And smaller than the smallest. I guess tips of hairs are measured in angstrom units or something like that. So Krishna is smaller than 1/10,000th the tip of a hair. As a super soul. Of course, maybe they'll say that even that's a measurable size. That size you can probably see with an electron microscope or something. But Krishna is sukshmatvat. He's very subtle. The air may be big, but you can't see it. The atmosphere is much larger than a penny, but you can see a penny and you can't see the atmosphere because it's subtle. And the soul is where the mind, you can't see the mind, intelligence. But this, so the soul is subtle, it can't be seen. But it's described as being microscopic, submicroscopic in size. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that the marvelous thing about Krishna is not that he's greater than the greatest, greater, or that he's smaller than the smallest, but that he's both at the same time. That's inconceivable. And still he maintains his charming medium size. Well, anusmared means somehow or other always thinking of Krishna, thinking of Krishna, thinking of Krishna, go on, thinking of Krishna, thinking of Krishna. Anu means always, and anu means following. We have to think of Krishna following in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. In that way, we have to maintain on Krishna. Krishna's inconceivable achintya kaluye bhava naivam tarkena yojyeta. That the no use arguing about that which is inconceivable, because it's inconceivable beyond argument. But therefore Prabhupada's conclusion is that we simply have to accept the version of Shastra's revealed scriptures, and in that way probably that will lead one to understanding. We may understand or not understand, but if we follow the process, we'll come to understand Krishna. Maybe why don't we take some questions or comments or discussions or something like that.
If you say something is a chintya, does that rule out all philosophy and all sort of speculative thinking?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It means you won't get it by any amount of speculative thinking. Chiram vichindam. Then it won't really get us there. So then the question is, why are we presenting these books? Why all the philosophy? Why arguments? And the answer is just to help people get it who are addicted to philosophy, speculation. Otherwise, a simple person, if he just surrenders to Krishna, he gets the result. Or a great philosopher, if he surrenders to Krishna, he gets the result. So for those who require philosophy, philosophy is there. But it's not speculative. We appear sometimes, one time Satsuru Maharaj wrote a letter to Prabhupada saying, apparently suggesting that our method is that to convince people we use a combination of, or that is our, he was asking about how we understand, is it that combination of logic and logic and authority. Prabhupada said, no, it's just authority. But logic we use just to convince others. Maybe we use it to convince ourselves also. But we don't exactly understand. Our method is not actually by logic, it's by hearing. It's a different method. And it's not, it's a method we fight all the way. Our particularly Western, you know, everything's speculation and argument. Or for that matter, it's not that the West has the monopoly on speculation. India certainly has speculative schools of philosophy. But ultimately, we're not going to understand by speculation. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, big intellectual speculator, he didn't get it. He got it when he got Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy. Is that okay? Yeah?
And Krishna says, you rush just to flash your flesh, but then that's everyone is saying this to me, he'll come to me. But then, in the next verse, it says, "But those are have knowledge; they're very dear to me. They want most more dear to me.
Artartartija gyasugyanija. They're all Sukriti, pious souls. But Krishna says those who are coming for business, that's one thing. They're coming, oh God, we're so great, so huge, so gigantic. We're kind of short this week, could you do something? So that's all right, they're approaching God. Or someone's curious, that's all right. Or someone's in distress, oh God, I'm in such distress. But someone who's coming just to know God as he is, Krishna says he's better. He's not such a pest. Give me. His basic principle is knowledge. Otherwise, they're all good. But one is basic. Yeah, otherwise, we see Prabhupada said practically that someone comes for the sake of getting money, and then he gets money, and then he goes. When he's in distress, then he turns to God, and then his distress is taken care of, alleviated, and then he goes. The person who's seeking to know Krishna, that's considered better. Is that okay?
Yes, but it was just in relation to this question of...
Actually, they're all neophytes, even the Gyani. It's not that that's so. Gyani is... Krishna's not known as Gyani Vatsala. Bhakta Vatsala, he actually wants a devotee. Yeva janti tamam bhaktya. One who serves me with love, I'm in him and he's in me. So that's the real thing. But for those who are beginners, this is very good to come somehow or other, whether for out of distress, in need of money, curiosity, or seeking knowledge. But that's the effect. The gopis aren't approaching God for knowledge. Yashoda, none of the Vrijvasis are approaching God for knowledge. They're approaching Krishna out of love. And that's the higher thing. These are all neophytes, all four. Yes. Yeah.
My question is still related to Robert's question. I have all my own. Anyway,
this is all speculation he's going to say.
Yes, my speculation is going on, and I was just attending this particular college and Indian philosophy course, and it was about Vedanta, and then it was interesting that how like personalistic school and an impersonalistic school, how they claim their conclusion against each other. But ultimately, it seems that both sides says that, ultimately speaking, it's inconceivable. For example, like impersonalist school says that, something personal comes from impersonal. That's what they say. But then we ask, how come like something comes from nothing? Mm. And then, but they say that's inconceivable. And then they say that you have to surrender in order to understand. And we say that personal, impersonal, has all pervading impersonal feature is somehow within personal form. And then why? It's inconceivable. And we also say, well, you have to surrender, you have to understand. And it seems that if we start talking about inconceivability, then it comes to the point where it's just your conclusion depending on your faith commitment. That's what I seem to mean.
From one point of view, that's true. Impersonal Brahman is inconceivable, and Krishna, the personality of God, is inconceivable. But why does one approach one the other? It's not exactly logic.
Yeah, then that's why the so-called scientific people don't like theology, because they think that theology the all conclusion of theologian is predetermined by their faith.
It is.
And that's true. And then of course these so-called scientific people, they also have their own commitment.
So which is also determined by faith.
Right. So as much as they
discounted. Not specific that every specific conclusion is determined by faith, but some of their basic principles.
Such as?
Hmm? Their operating assumptions. Not always. I mean, it's not a rule of science that everything has to be by faith. But I've read, for example, some book about body and mind, and you know, it was about paranormal things. And finally, a very intelligent lady, who's a scholar and so on, and she finally just concluded that such and such thing couldn't be right because we know that, and she was back to materialism again, that because everything comes from the brain, everything comes from.
Patricia Churchland?
Hmm?
Was it Patricia Churchland?
No, she was an older, previous generation.
It seems that whether it's like, to me at least, whether you commit like one particular tradition or like commit to scientific tradition or whatever tradition you commit to, it seems to me it's just everything is determined.
By faith, yeah. These whatchamacallit guys, the scientific creationists, the new guys, intelligent design guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's faith, ultimately. You know, even to begin with, it's faith. You know, they have faith in God, and then they're going to show that it's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Very few of those intelligent creationists, intelligent design people, I would gather, are just starting from, well, it's just logical. They're starting from, you know, we believe in God, and now let's validate that scientifically. The leaders, at least, I think, are starting from that position. And there can be some people who are uncommitted and join the ranks, but largely, you know, it's a lot of faith there. And the scientific materialists, the reductionists and so on, they have faith that matter can, you know, from matter we can derive everything. It's a kind of a faith project. So why does one end up in one camp, one in the other camp? You can make logical arguments for either one. You can go far enough that to leave a lot of people in the dust in terms of, well, that's too high for me, I can't follow that, it just seems to me, and then they say something simpler. So, you know, like both sides can make complex arguments that have a lot of rigor and so on. Why does one guy end up in one camp and one guy end up in the other camp? Finally, it's pious or impious activities. Someone ends up a demon, to use the uncharitable pejorative, that word that we'll never use in polite company. Someone ends up a rabid atheist. Why? Because of his past impious activities. You just can't get it. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by faith?
I mean in this context a predisposition to accept spiritual
garbage
authority.
Spiritual
behave
authority.
Yourself. Predisposition to accept spiritual authority and to accept the existence of spiritual truth. It's a kind of faith. It doesn't have to be Christian faith or, you know, that denominational faith, but an openness to accepting that there's soul, that there's God, that requires a certain amount of. It's a kind of faith. Now, it may be linked in with reason, or what, you know, there may be a relationship to logic and argument and reason. There's so many logical, argumentative, and reasonable people who say, "Bah, humbug." Why? Why have they wound up in one side of the issue, the other people in the other? Like we were discussing today at lunch, you know, there were all these incredibly intelligent, cultured, efficient people who were busy burning people in ovens in World War II. You know, how did they end up doing something like that? You know, what possessed these people? And you know, they had arguments for it, they had reasons, they had scientists doing it and doctors and all sorts of people on this program. How did they wind up doing such things? Yeah. And finally, it's because of their past impious activities. Agyanam abhijatasya partasampadam asarim. Demonic qualities. Daivi sampad and asuri sampad. Divine qualities. You know, somebody couldn't dream of, couldn't dream of hurting a... I know among my friends, we had different kinds of kids. I remember one kid, he was showing me with great glee a little thing he'd learned to do. You catch some little guppies, and then you put them on a rock outside the water, and you can take a magnifying glass and train it on them until they cook and explode. Yeah, nice little kid. Some kids take pleasure in doing all these scientific experiments. Hare Krishna. These horrible things. Some kids are like bullies and creeps, and they'll do horrible things. And these are brought up in a nice family, good homes, and this is like fun. And then there are other kids, have a different kind of nature. So why is that? Pious and impious background. So Prabhupada also, why are these people Duskritana, Mudha, Naradama, Maya, Pratigana? Duskritana, because of past impious activities. Their knowledge is misused. They have all these assets. Some of these, we get some guy who's a devotee and he says, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. How do you know? Because Prabhupada said so. Because the Shastras say so. How do you know? Because the Shastras are always right. And then you get some very sophisticated professor who looks and says, on the one hand this, on the other hand this, and then they make this argument, and they make that argument, and there's a counter, another way of looking at it, and you can consider it this way, and you can consider it that way, but all things told, there is no such thing as a personality of Godhead. It's really, there's no reason to accept the existence of a personality of Godhead. Very sophisticated, very intelligent, very balanced, very sharp, and very much unwilling to accept any superior authority. So according to the analysis of Bhagavad Gita, it's because of the modes of material nature, past pious or impious activities.
Well, I don't know if you're agreeing with what he was saying, but it seemed like he was trying to say that I agree that there's different types of people and they have different inclinations to accept different paths. But I think it feels reasonable. They read.
I
remember taking philosophy classes, and some people read David Hume and are like, "Yeah, this makes sense."
Right.
Other people read Aquinas. No, this makes.
This
sense.
Makes sense. Yeah. So why does one make sense for the Hume people?
Feeling. I think it really does come from their own sense of.
It does.
It really does feel true.
Absolutely. It's not just that they're putting it on. Well. I belong to the Atheist League, so I can't accept Thomas Aquinas. It would be against my principles. I've already decided the matter. No, it just really feels right to them. Aquinas seems like an ass, and Hume seems like brilliant, or vice versa. But why?
Yeah, but I don't agree that, say somebody reads the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada's Gita, makes a lot of sense. That necessarily implicates one or it necessarily forces one to accept the whole kit and caboodle, so to speak. Or that you're necessarily like, I've taken A, now I'm going to have to take all the way to Z.
And we see that. You take an argument A, therefore B, therefore C, therefore Nope.
Nope, yeah.
So, why? So again, we'd say, on account of one's previous activities. Somebody picks up the Bhagavad Gita and says, this is it! You know, all my life I've been, it all makes perfect, you know. Why is that? And then they immediately begins chanting, immediately begins following the principles, immediately this, immediately that. It means in his previous life he performed devotional service. If we take it from Bhagavad Gita, that's the reason. It's not just because it's so incredibly logical, because the person sitting right next to him says, you know, what's gotten into you? Oh, it makes perfect sense. Man, look at this. This is stupid. This doesn't say, you know, you believe this? Get off it, man. So why? On account of previous pious activities. Or out of, you can say, the grace of God, by somebody's been blessed with the good fortune to be receptive to God's message, Krishna's message. And someone else, no matter what, you know, go down in flames before they'd accept, you know, anything that vaguely resembles anything spiritual, religious, supernatural, transcendental, or any of that other.
But sometimes people accept the rules and very simply and it's for other reasons than genuine understanding of it.
Oh, that's my argument. That it's not really because it's so logical. Although it is.
But shouldn't it be logical too?
It is. Of course, there's some things that are not, that are beyond logical. You can't really say, you know, that it's logical that God should be half lion and half man. I mean, that's only logical that he should appear that way. I mean, you know, it's not like out of logical necessity that we accept that.
It makes sense.
But it's not, you know, a logical imperative that drives us to that conclusion. It's on acceptance of higher authority. So, again, yes, we accept it because it makes sense, or, you know, all these other reasons, because the people around me, you know, I was in a crowd of people who accepted it, and somehow or other I accepted it. Or, you know, I was in some sort of difficulty, and in this difficulty I turned to this book, and, you know, that seemed to answer my questions. You know, and then you get these sociological explanations of why a person turns to God. And it's true, Krishna accepts it. Arta artarti. You know, he was in distress, he was in economic straits or whatever, what have you. But then why? Someone else was in distress and he said, damn it, there's no God. Otherwise, why would I be suffering like this? Why would this have happened? I, you know, spit on the very thought of God. And someone else, you know, in the same kind of difficulty, turns to God. But why? Someone, one person in economic distress, goes to church, the other goes to see his banker. You know why? So, yeah, the context is that, I mean, obviously the presentation is made in such a way that it should be sensible, it should be reasonable, it should be logical, it should be all of these things. But finally, it's by good fortune. It's by good fortune. It's not exactly necessary by logic, by all of those other features. By logic, you can, you know, make anything into anything and then back into anything else. Lord Chaitanya, he used to prove some proposition by logic, then disprove it by logic, and then again establish it by logic, the same proposition. You know, that you can go on like that. So, I accept that a person reads, and, I mean, in other words, why are we distributing books? It's not, you probably said, if they just touch it, they're purified, but, it's, you know, we could save a lot of money just by printing, you know, something will touch me on the front. It doesn't have to be 1,000 pages and hard binding. Yes?
I'm just curious what you think about Plato. He thought
I don't think about Plato because I haven't studied Plato.
Okay. But yeah. just in this regard, he thought that knowledge, to know something, to say this person knows something, they had the thing that they knew had to, they had to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have justification for what they believed, and it had to be true.
Why? For a person to say to actually know something, or say
well,
he knows it.
To actually know something,
It has to be true.
So in regard to this discussion,
say it again.
They have to believe it first of all, and they have to have some justification for it, some rational justification for it, and the belief has to be true. And that's knowledge. Knowledge is a belief that you possess, which is justified by you, and which is true. And so, in this discussion,
I guess it's a question of definition. Like a plant knows, a dog knows to, where to get his dog food, but does he know that by rational thought? I don't really know. A plant knows to grow to the sun. Is that a result of having a rational belief or something? I don't really know. And it's by definition that we say that if you believe something and it's not true, then it's not knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a question of defining.
Is there, in that scenario, probably makes a differentiation between material and spiritual knowledge? He seems to indicate that there can be different principles at work with spiritual knowledge. It may not be spiritual knowledge may not be dependent on certain justifications.
Generally, we see it becomes almost psychology. That a person knows something. And we generally, when you know something, why do you know something? Well, how do you know? And then the person has to provide a reasonable explanation. But whether he really knows it because of the rational explanation he gave or not, I can't say. I'm thinking of paranormal phenomena where somebody just knows that. There's going to be a problem. He just knows it. He knows that there's, I just know I shouldn't go to this place on Tuesday. Don't ask me why, I just know it. And then, Tuesday, a bomb falls on the place. Now, he irrationally knew it. He doesn't know why. He didn't, it's not really logical. Just somehow or other, he had this some sort of feeling, I can't explain it, I just know I shouldn't do it. A person instinctively knows that I shouldn't put money here, something's, of course, he doesn't even know, he can't explain exactly what it is that makes him think it's fishy. But he knows, and sure enough, the guy's a crook. So, again, I don't want to take on Plato without having a strong grasp of his argument. But for a person to get spiritual knowledge, it's not exactly dependent on any material acquisition. It's dependent on Krishna's mercy. A person gets knowledge.
What does knowledge mean in that context, then? If it doesn't mean that you have some understanding or experience of
experience,
of
maybe
what you're
experience.
Isn't that vikam?
Yeah, that's it.
In Indian philosophy, knowledge is subservient to, or superseded by, gyan and vikam. There's a qualifier to knowledge. Knowledge in itself, I may know not the body, but I may not realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And realizing it is considered much more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And knowledge is...
And the person who has realization may not be able even to explain. You know, you tell a Gurukul kid, like a Gurukul kid sees a karmi eating meat and he just says, ooh. And he may not even understand exactly what's wrong with it, all the, you know, ethical, you know, 17 arguments against meat eating and so on. It just, you know, it's just, Or, you know, Prahlad Maharaj was playing with Radha Krishna dolls. You know, what kind of intellectual process was involved there? He just loved them. He just loved Krishna. Try and get into the analytical analysis of love. You know, on what rational basis does anybody love anybody? Probably if rationality were called into service, no, there'd be no love left in the material world. You know, it's all more or less, you have to be out of your mind to love anybody here. And, you know, they make up rationalizations, you know, because she's so smart, because she loves me so much, because she's so beautiful, because she's so devoted, because she's so chaste, because, you know, really it's just because I lost my marbles. And, you know, so. So, with Krishna also, you know, a pure, spontaneous devotee like Prahlad Maharaj, he just loves Krishna. Now, of course, he also, at least by the time he was 5 years old or so, he was able to give persuasive reasons for his point of view. But higher than knowledge is love. Jashoda Mai, Nanda Maharaj, they don't even have knowledge. Knowledge is hidden from them, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They don't have knowledge. They don't believe. If you tell them that Krishna is God, they don't believe it. Yeah, just the opposite. They don't know it. They don't believe it. But they love him anyway. It's a higher principle. A spiritual force that works beyond the realm of knowledge. So, of course, on those grounds, one can, you know, well, then we throw away logic and argument and we just surrender ourselves to our, to love, to feelings. You know, you can really get screwed up that way. Mm-hmm. But but those things are there. But because we're after argument, we want everything to be sensible, reasonable, established. So many arguments are given in scripture. But that's more or less to accommodate our need for arguments. Otherwise, Krishna also says in Bhagavad Gita, the best thing is just love me spontaneously. Then if you can't do that, then follow some principles to develop love for me. If you can't do that, then do some pious work.
No, you answered it better than I.
Than you expected, huh? You didn't think I was going to give a good answer.
you said it even better. No, I was just going to squeak.
That's okay.
Sorry, I was going to squeak about that. It's all about, I mean, the premise believing the man is a rational animal and limiting him to that. But like you said, there's a whole super rational dimension too. Mm-hmm. And exactly, I think there's a need for rational. It takes you so far, but if you're to limit man's understanding or knowledge just to rational knowledge, then you don't understand the nature of the beast. And yes, like spiritual pervades material, so the mind also has experience. And exactly like you said about the gopis, they're just like Krishna. But I was thinking of myself in experience, something like, for example, an abhishek. You know, you try to explain to somebody about an abhishek, you pour yogurt on the statue and some honey and then do some more, and the whole thing sounds so stupid, or not just like. But when you're actually in an abhishek, it's the sweetest thing in the world, where time stands still, and it's just, you just find yourself smiling, even if the whole, you know, it's not a rational experience. There's nothing rational about it. And I think.
But it is rational because you're having an experience, which is satisfying. And that's reasonable.
Right, to that extent.
It things can be rationally.
I just don't like this, the dichotomy between reason and non-reason. It doesn't.
I think both are there. I'm not saying one without the other, but I'm just saying, you know, if both are there, one takes you so far and is very helpful to support the other, but the other is a whole dimension
of reality. And I think on the basis of both, you make your judgments. You know, so understanding doesn't have to be limited to rational understanding. And like what you said, the gopis, exactly that. They just love Krishna. And that's it. And that's it. It just, and I think that also when you meet a sadhu, like I'm sure people met Prabhupada, or even when you come here and people like, even no matter what you said, there's something about you. There's a sort of a supra-rational taste.
When we meet devotees, it works beyond.
Yeah, it's just nice.
It has an effect. We're not. It's not exactly that a person is persuaded necessarily by your good logic.
Yeah, not at all.
There's a trans. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that Krishna consciousness is like an electric current communicated from one sympathetic soul to another. So that's not, I mean, that's in one sense a rational explanation of how it works. And in one sense it could be criticized too as being just totally sentimental. You know, I've seen it. But we take it on his authority that's essentially what's working, that there's an energy of Krishna, is internal energy, which is communicated to the living entity. And by the influence of that internal energy, he's uplifted and gets to see something or gets to have some experience. He's chanting Hare Krishna. So, therefore, Prabhupada said, he may understand or not understand. Someone is chanting. It should be that by some intellectual, the more he understands it intellectually, the better. But it's not like that. If he chants with understanding, without understanding, if he chants sincerely, the process will work. Because he's coming, if we accept that Krishna's name is non-different from Krishna, he's coming in touch with Krishna. He may understand or not. Prabhupada said that about his own hearing from his spiritual master. He said that he spoke from such a high platform that even when he would speak in Bengali, I couldn't follow. And I couldn't understand. He said, but I thought, let me go on hearing. I may understand or not understand, let me go on hearing. And his spiritual master became pleased. Prabhupada gave the example that someone is sleeping and someone is calling his name, Mr. John, wake up, wake up. He doesn't understand what's being said, but gradually, because the vibration is there, he gradually wakes up. And then he understands. So, it works by a trend, therefore it's a transcendental process. It's not exactly an intellectual process. We use intellect, we have arguments, we've got lots of philosophy. We can spar with the best of them in terms of intellectual arguments, philosophical arguments. But finally, the person who gets the mercy of Krishna can understand. The Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who's a big logician, why didn't he get it? And finally, when he got the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then he understood. Otherwise, his brother-in-law was giving him good arguments, why didn't he just surrender? There's something else involved there. I don't want to, throw everything off into the realm of sentiment and so on. Our process is logical. It does have argument, philosophy, everything. And a person is impressed by the logic, by the philosophy, by when I first came, wow, they answered that question. Wow, they answered, I was shooting arrows at them like anything, trying to punch a hole in somewhere. Wow, they, that one didn't work. Wow, that one didn't work. Wow, that one didn't work. So it's impressive. Finally, you can say, wow, we've got something. And if otherwise you look and say, bah. But, if the substance is there, and with impressive depth to it, impressive argumentation behind it. But finally, who gets it? The person who's got some mercy from Krishna. Prasada leshanu bhite. We give you know, our professors, how do the professors become impressed by our books and philosophy and so on? And so on? They get some prasadam. Right? We see, you know, the biggest intellectuals, the biggest, you know, stalwart minds of the world, if they get prasadam long enough, they something might start to happen.
How we got all our academic advisory council here.
Yeah.
There's Jim Benson, who didn't want to have anything to do with us, and came to a meeting dragged by Tom Hopkins and myself, and sat down, and there was no books in the library, a room full of shelves, not a single book, and two tables put together. And we sat down, and Maria cooked a really nice meal, and we used these prasad things, and he sat there for 3 hours, eating the whole time. He didn't stop for a minute. And at the end of it, we asked him if he had been our advisor, and he said, yeah. So many Nick Allen, all these people came on board, just took a minute to fed them for prasad.
Yeah, we have our philosophical meetings, but we have chanting, we have prasad. Because we know that it doesn't work just entirely by an appeal to logic. The logic is there, but there's something else.
Could you expand a little bit more what you mean with piety and Krishna's mercy?
The piety, sukriti, it means actions that are favorable for purification and ultimately for devotional service. So they come in different categories. If a person has, you know, dug wells for the public welfare, planted trees by the side of the road, given charity, so those are pious activities. But the real pious activity is to perform some devotional service. Those things may be counted as devotional service in the sense that they're constituents of the Vedic process, which culminates ultimately in devotional service. Mm. In that sense, even fruitive activities performed according to Vedic rituals or mental speculation, worship of demigods, all those things can be counted as preliminary ingredients of devotional service, performing the yoga system or what have you. But they're very preliminary, but they're something. So the whole thing is, let's get this guy into the Vedic world somehow or other. You know, let him perform pious activity, perform charity, let him give something, undergo some austerity. That's not really devotional service, but it's the beginning of devotional service, seen from that angle of vision. Or from another angle, real devotional service begins when someone comes in touch with a pure devotee. If he knowingly or unknowingly renders service, or if he even thinks, oh, this devotee is a nice, nice person, and then some real pious activity begins. Otherwise, devotional service, it's said elsewhere, no amount of pious activities can bring one to devotional service. But they can purify the heart to some extent. A person who performs impious activities, you know, just becomes mean, nasty, puffed up, foolish, you know, drinking, smoking, beating people over the head, you know, all these horrible things that people can do. That's not pious activity, that's impious activity. And then various kindnesses, giving oneself to others, trying to help people, giving somebody something to eat, giving a place to stay, you know, all these things may be counted as pious activities.
Just thinking, because I mean, for example, you can do things in a way that is even pious activity in a very passionate treatment way, you know, like the mentality is very
but it's pious. You know, somebody, for name and fame, he gave money to the church. But somehow or other he gave his money for the glorification of God. It's considered a pious activity. Maybe not, it's not pure devotional service, that's a different thing. But the same guy, for name and fame, could have robbed a bank and, you know, shot the teller, blown up a school building.
Yes. I think what I'm getting is in one sense, looking at it, you see it like the living entity is either covered, you know, by the karma, or by the activity that's performed, by the karmic activity, or the pious or impious.
Yeah.
But in other way, is looking also at the desire of the living entity, and the amount of envy, you know, because we could say, isn't there somehow within the living entity the, well, isn't it basically, I don't know how to express this, but it feels like it's somehow to do with the desire or the attitude of the soul.
Well, the original attitude of the soul is that he wants to serve Krishna. But when he comes in touch with the material energy, or when he misuses his independence, then he gets this other desire, let me enjoy. Let me control, let me enjoy. And then according to what sort of modes of nature he comes into, that let me enjoy takes different forms. Let me enjoy by giving pleasure to others, by feeding them, by giving them homes where they can stay, by digging wells, by planting trees. Or let me enjoy by, you know, beating them in business and, you know, wiping them out and adding to my empire. Or let me enjoy by, you know, screw everything, give me a joint, you know. Or something more, you know, shoot this, snort that, enjoy. So it's the same motive. Somebody wants to enjoy, somebody wants to enjoy. But according to the modes of nature, someone enjoys by giving suffering to others. This little kid was enjoying, you know, watching little guppies explode. And that was his enjoyment. Look at them. Megari was enjoying seeing animals half killed. Enjoyment in the mode of ignorance. And then there's enjoyment in goodness and passion.
But somehow, even those different modes doesn't seem to help people take up Krishna consciousness. I mean, you could.
No, finally, no amount of pious activity will bring one to Krishna consciousness. You can be as pious as you want, and you'll wind up being just extremely pious.
Mm.
So it depends on coming in touch with a pure devotee. Even an impious person, Mirgari was impious. But by contact with a pure devotee, he became better than pious. The pious people were going to see how this hunter had become a devotee. He surpassed them. So it's an advantage if someone is, you know, it's extraordinary that a person who was such a mean hunter became a devotee. So that was by the power of Narad Muni. Otherwise, persons who are pious, it's easier. It fits for them. It's natural, you know. To they're obedient, they're submissive, they're humble, they're clean, they're next to godliness. They have godly qualities. So for them to get the message of God is easier. If a prophet came to America, he thought, how are these people ever going to get it? They're covered by passion and ignorance. How are they ever going to understand this message? Look at these people. How are they ever going to understand it? They said, but your message is very strong. Tada rajastamo bhava kama lobhadiyasche jaydeyantar. Nityam bhagavata sevya, by hearing, by chanting, by serving. And even they can become. But it's implicit that it's understood that a pious person, it would have been easier. They're almost there, just you have to. You know, like the example is dry leaves, and you know, if the spark flies on dry leaves, you can ignite it. If it falls on the ground, it's another thing. If it falls in the water, it's like, forget it. So the mode of ignorance is, wow, practically the spiritual instincts are extinguished. Although he's pure spirit soul, the same as the next guy, but he's so covered by ignorance that it's hard for him to get it. And a person who's in the mode of goodness is, you know, has the advantage. Like dry leaves.
So given what you've just been saying about pious activities, and before you were saying how one can only perform devotional service if they've done it in the previous life, there's this well-known conversation where someone said to Prabhupada, how is it that we could have come to devotional service because we were performing so many sinful activities? And Prabhupada apparently said, I am your pious credit.
I've created your pious activities.
So how do we understand that?
That's called by touch with a pure devotee. Just like a girl, she's beautiful, she's young, she's sweet, she's everything. So that doesn't make her pregnant. Now, maybe they may be predisposing factors. Because she's young, she's beautiful, so men may be attracted. But finally, the man has to be there. Otherwise, independently, she'll never be pregnant. So pious activities on their own, because a person is, you know, advanced in pious activities, so that's helpful. But finally, without the touch of devotional service, it doesn't happen.
Cloning.
Sorry?
Cloning.
Fertilization.
Yeah. Cloning. You split the embryo.
What he meant was without outside intervention. You have to give his 1950s upbringing.
There are parasites that can stop very long.
Anyway, as Prabhupada used to say, crude example.
Crude intervention.
Crude intervention. Okay.
I read an article in a book called The Hare Krishna Movement, and it said that it was explaining that the Madhyama Adhikari platform is plagued by profound religious doubt, and its hallmark is skepticism. And I'd always thought it was the other way around, but I wondered if there's any...
The other way around, meaning?
Well, that you were fixed up in faith when you were on the Madhyama Adhikari platform.
Think about that.
Was there scriptural evidence given for that? Or that mm-hmm.
Is that Shukabak's article?
Yes, that's right.
That's taken from Bhaskara Thakur, who was defining the Adhikaris in a slightly different way than Prabhupada did.
One thing you could say is that as long as he's plagued by doubt and so on, skepticism, that keeps him from becoming an Uttama Adhikari. You can be looked at that way. It could be analyzed that way. Otherwise, atheists are plagued by doubts and skepticism also. You don't have to be any kind. They have like zero adhikar. Sub kanishta. Infra kanishta. But, you know, so they have lots of skepticism, but you can say it progressively disappears as one goes from Kanishta Adhikari to Madhyama Adhikari to Madhikari.
But that profound religious doubt wasn't supposed to be there in Kanishta Adhikari.
Well, as Chanakya Ram was saying, this, you know, must be, he's using the terminology differently.
Quite differently.
Mm. They're different. From one angle of vision, Kanishta, Madhyam Kanishta, Uttam, it's measured in terms of how he deals with those around him. From another angle of vision, it deals with how much his faith is developed. It can be, you know, the same terminology can be used differently. Yes, sir?
Back into the mercy topic, I guess we sort of, well, you said that ultimately speaking, like who becomes devotee and who not, depending on the mercy, the fortune, then I guess this is sort of classical question, but then how to what extent it's mercy and to what extent is effort. And then my question is if ultimately it's dependent on mercy of Krishna, then
mercy and receptivity.
Right. Then what's the position of like a how do you say people go out and the preacher like a mission? What's the position of like a missionary effort?
He's looking for receptivity. Mm-hmm. He's distributing good fortune, and he's especially looking for receptivity. So you go out, you distribute books, you meet someone who's enormously receptive. Oh, you know, I was looking for this book. Oh, this is fantastic. Oh, wow, that artwork is so beautiful. And, wow, how much did it cost? $25? I can't believe it. Wow, you know, boom, boom, boom. Here, take 30. You know, they're just receptive like anything. And where's your temple? Do you have a temple around here? Can I come? I can really come? They're just enormously receptive. And somebody else, well, I don't know, you know, nah, forget it, no time, goodbye, sorry, nope, no time. You know, not even, wouldn't give you a second. And somebody else, you kind of have to persuade him, and he looks in and says, well, maybe, okay, and, you know, takes it home, gives it to his wife and says, you know, I don't know why I bought this, here, you, maybe you'd be interested in this kind of thing.
Right.
So, but, you know, so he did some service, even if he didn't read it himself, he just gave it to his wife and gave you, you know, $4 for it.
Right. So but my question is, to get somebody attracted to Krishna consciousness, to what extent we should push?
That's a matter of judgment.
Right.
That's a matter of judgment.
Right.
Obviously, if you push too hard, you can end up in jail. And if you're not a little bit, you know, if you have no drive, then you won't even go out.
Right.
So it's a matter of some discretion.
Mm.
It takes time to develop.
Lifetimes to develop.
And Krishna's mercy.
And Krishna's mercy.
Right.
Good association. In general, it requires a little. It's a question of, in one sense, it's your own desire. You know, our successful book distributors or preachers, what's a big ingredient of their success? They so much desire that the person get the book. You know, they're just desire. It's described that there's different ways that a person gets mercy. One is just by desire. Someone is desiring. I think Narad Muni was desiring that Prahlad Maharaj should be a devotee. So just by desire, you know, you're desiring so much, this people are so much in need of this knowledge, I have to somehow or other get them to take it. And then a person, you know, he doesn't exactly understand why, but he just sees that you're so much, you know, you're so keen on giving it to him. He doesn't exactly understand what it is, but it seems that your desire is so strong. And if it's weak, the person says, I don't want it. You say, okay. Because it wasn't a big issue for you, you know. And that's why it wasn't a big issue for him. You know, your desire wasn't very strong. Neither his wasn't there at all.
Right.
Between the two of you, you got nowhere.
Yeah, so you're saying that the conviction attracts?
Yeah, even in ordinary sales.
Right.
And the salesman is just, you know, is enthusiastic and really just wants to sell it to you and, you know, you do try this, try that, you know, well, what about this? Or maybe, you know, your brother use one?
But the devotees can't just be pushing, they have to be sensitive.
That also, and salesmen too, you know, the salesman, couldn't your brother use this? Listen, I told you, get lost, all right? You know, there's such a thing as playing your cards wrong. So
we call it noxious pushy feeling.
The noxious pushy feeling, yeah.
Pushy feeling.
But so the desire has to be there, and then some sensitivity, some experience also. one gets to learn that, you know, how to read other people's signals and what to, you know, and Krishna helps also. If you're desiring, then Krishna helps you. Somehow or other, you may not be skilled, you may not be educated, you may not even speak the language. Mm. We have devotees distributing books to people who don't even speak the same language. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it? Why are people taking books from them? You know, the desire is strong and Krishna's helping, and somehow or other, message gets across.
Yeah.
Mm? Conviction. Prabhupada said in the time of emergency, and when there's a fire in the house, the neighbors may or may not understand the language, but somehow or other they get across
right.
The need.
Yeah, it was interesting that I was just meeting Kamchandra Maharaj, and he said when he was distributing books in Japan, actually his distributing books went down when he learned Japanese. Because then you start speaking sort of like a half, kind of like a language, and then the Japanese kind of start wondering what actually, you know, is he trying to cheat or something? Whereas before he was just speaking English and he doesn't communicate, but somehow he was sort of producing sort of a helpless situation, in that way getting some compassion.
Something else?
Well, you've traveled this morning. You've rung me out all day. So maybe we should
call it quitsies.
Is there some recitation for the evening?
You want to sing a little song again?
Let's sing a little song. For instance.
Yeah.
And tomorrow morning at 7:30, Maharaj will be conducting morning programs from 7:30.
Okay. Who's singing? Chanavi.
Yeah?
Yeah, just...
Me?
Yeah. Well, it could be anyone.
Mary?
Yeah?
Yeah? Right there? You got some really natty tunes. Tunes to frighten swamis.
Oh my goodness. Well, anyway, all at once now.